The band The Flaming Lips are a phenomenon, a slow-growing one at that. They formed in 1985 in Oklahoma City, signed to a major label in 1991. Had kind of a freak hit with the song She Don't Use Jelly, you may remember that. And now with their last two albums, The Soft Bulletin and Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots, their audience has certainly grown. The trio, including the acknowledged Lips leader Wayne Coyne, recorded this new one at War with the Mystics, working once again with Dave Fridman of Mercury Rev fame producing. We'll get to some live performance, but my conversation with Wayne Coyne started as we discussed the latest cover song that the Flaming Lips have been using on stage. It's Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody.
Well, there was, I guess it's going almost a year ago now, there was someone's putting together a Queen tribute album. And they asked us to be involved, and we said yes, that we would, but, we didn't know which song we were going to pick. And we honestly, we shied away from Bohemian Rhapsody only because it's such a behemoth of a song. And then we waited and waited, and no one picked Bohemian Rhapsody. And then they kind of came to us at the end and said, "You got to do Bohemian Rhapsody, fellas. Nobody else has picked it." So we sort of reluctantly took up the torch, so to speak. You know, here's our own version of Bohemian Rhapsody. And then I think our next thought after that would have been to see if we could perform it live in front of people. And that's what we've been doing now for, like you were saying, maybe about a year or so since we recorded it.
There's something, just they're kind of, I've always seen Queen as kind of, in many ways, a cartoony band, in that they're always over the top, and that's just so absolutely wonderful about the band. One could say there's elements of that in what the Flaming Lips do. But I've heard you say some things, Wayne, about how you were never until now particularly comfortable with just being completely foolish on stage, and now you that's not something you would shy away from.
Well, you're right, because there is, especially when you're insecure, you think, oh my God, that you're really goofy to begin with. You're really kind of an uncomfortable, stupid person, and you pretend to be kind of serious and important. And I think little by little, as I've gone along, especially when I'm standing in the audience watching bands and performers, I just love it when they're not afraid to be ridiculous. We all know it's supposed to be a show, and this pretending, this pretension of cool and all that, I think sometimes just ruins the night. And luckily, as the Flaming Lips have gone along, we've been able to just embrace the absurdness of life, as opposed to trying to pretend that it's all serious and we're all in control and all that. And I think that really makes the event a lot better, because, when you see the performer not afraid to be embarrassed and not afraid of this sort of public humiliation, it makes you not afraid. And I think that really that's doing a great service to anybody who comes to see the band. You really do see how this fear of humiliation haunts people. It really does. And I have no fear of that anymore, Dave.
I love that. I love that. And I love that if you come to the show, you should not feel that way either. Today's set is not going to begin with that, but a couple of other covers, which go together in an unlikely, likely way, which is a Sonic Youth tune, and we won't even say what the next one is yet, because we'll let people experience that. But how did this come together?
Well, this was, some people don't realize that the Flaming Lips have been around for, it's almost going on 25 years now. We started in 1983, all right? And so, when we would first go out on the road, we would, like a lot of bands, you'd only have like a handful of your own songs that you're playing, and you would have to fill this thing up with a bunch of cover tunes. And at the time, we did a cover version of Death Valley 69. A lot of people won't remember that. It's like that Sonic Youth's great burst out hit, I think back in 1985 it must have been. And someone recorded this this little segue of our set where we played, we're not going to give away the secret yet, but we played Sonic Youth. And then in what proved to be almost a sort of hallmark of what the Flaming Lips were all about, we played a very cliched arena rock sort of superstar cover band from the 70s right next to it. And I think at the time people thought that we had taken too much LSD or had lost our minds or were just stupid or something. And so in hindsight, that proved to be a really, you know, a really great moment for us. So we, 20 years later, we thought, well, why don't we do that sort of thing again? So you hear us, you'll hear us start off with a brand new Sonic Youth song, a song off their last record called Unmade Bed, which is a wonderful, wonderful tune. And then you'll hear where that goes into this other secretive 70s over-the-top rock band. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Thank you. side with death. The devil mocks at every step.
Well, there you go. It's revealed. No quarter, the Led Zeppelin tune and Unmade Bed from Sonic Youth, as played by our guest today, Flaming Lips, as we warm up for our set of new tunes from At War with the Mystics. And we're getting a chance to talk with Wayne Coyne about these tunes and about how where things are with the band. At War with the Mystics, you did once again up in Fredonia, which is the Dave Fridman's space up in New York. And he is often described as the fourth lip. And tell me about that relationship, because I know it goes way back.
It does. We we knew Jonathan Donahue from the band Mercury Rev, which, you know, at one time he was actually in the Flaming Lips, and he had been friends with Dave Fridman. They got together when he was at the University of Buffalo, going back maybe even to 1986, 1987. We were getting ready to go and play some shows in California, opening up for, of all bands, Jane's Addiction. This was in 1988, I believe. And we asked Dave Fridman to come along as our live sound man on this sort of series of dates, which lasted only, I think, a couple of weeks. And he sort of reluctantly accepted. And I think once he accepted, and you all know people like this, that they're reluctant. Either they're not going to do it, or when they do it, they're going to go absolutely all the way. And so I think once he agreed that he was going to do it, he showed up with kind of a manifesto of, like, here's how I think I should run sound for you guys. And, like, and he treated it like the sound man. And this is new territory. You have to remember, back then in the late 80s, to have a sound man really be like part of the show. And he would walk around in a hospital smock, and you have to, like, I don't know how long it's been since you've been in the hospital, David, but he'd wear absolutely nothing but this hospital smock. I mean, no underwear, no shoes. He wore his hair kind of like up in a ponytail on top of his head. But he's a very serious-looking guy at the same time. And he would run the soundboard kind of like the way, you know, guys run guitar effects now, where he'd throw faders up and put effects on. And I remember sometimes we'd be playing shows, and half the people would be turning around watching Dave Fridman at the sound desk as opposed to watching me up there singing my great songs. Yeah. That's another form of humiliation. This whole thing is about overcoming that. And so, yeah, we've been working with him since about 1988, really. And then he built his own studio up in Fredonia, New York. That's Western New York. I guess it's 1996, and we've been recording up there really sort of ever since, yeah.
Now, I'm wondering, when you go in to do this album, I mean, the band is, as you know, even going all the way back to covering Sonic Youth, the band has had successes all along. Don't Use Jelly, of course, being a big big success,
right.
Other albums as big critical successes. But you have to admit that Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots, going gold and all that kind of sets you up in kind of a different position. Did you feel that? Did you feel like a follow-up more so than before?
Well, I mean, we felt it, but I don't think we felt it in this this tortured, oh, my God, what are we going to do next sort of way. And I say that only because I know Kevin Shields of My Bloody Valentine, one of the great procrastinators of all time, it turns out. And I talked to him even as far back as 1992. And you know, wondering where's the great follow-up to My Bloody Valentine's, you know, Loveless record. And him having great difficulty sort of coming to grips with what do you do after that? And even people compare it to, like, to Brian Wilson or something. What do you do when you've been given this helm of, like, you know, this freedom and these expectations? But I never really thought of it, any of it, as being a big deal. I was really just relieved that we knew that people liked what we did. But somewhere along the way, I think the Flaming Lips audience, it almost encourages us to go into the unknown and see what we can find. And there is a sense that if we failed, that it wouldn't be that big of a deal, that I think people would still accept us and say, ah, you know, hey, it didn't work out, but maybe next time. And so it's not just freedom thinking, well, you better do something good. It's freedom like, you know, let's see what happens. And the freedom to fail, gosh, you know, that's the greatest thing ever, because it really lets you take immense risks. You know, I didn't feel any real pressure other than let's just make a sort of unexpected record. And I think we do that almost as naturally as you can.
Right. Well, yeah. And that's actually not quite as ironic as you say that, because some people have real trouble getting off of a treadmill or doing anything differently than what they've done in the past. So it's definitely not a lips problem.
Right. I mean, these are things that really problems that people have in life. They're not just something associated with artists. I mean, I find that when me and my wife talk about going to get something to eat twice a week, you end up going to the same restaurant every time. You know, there's 100 great restaurants, yet you pick your favorite just out of comfort. And art and music and ideas are all the same sort of patterns we take. We get comfortable doing something, and you have to just, you know, stab yourself in the arm occasionally and get out of it. Yeah.
Well, let's hear some things from At War with the Mystics. And
speaking of stabbing ourselves in the arm.
the first thing we've got coming up here is actually ends up being the last piece on the record, Going On.
It is. This song, I think you'll hear it in there. There's a sense of kind of a, I hate to get too heavy about it, but I feel like it's kind of an existential acceptance almost. And that's, I know that sounds kind of vague and gray, but I think in there you hear... you hear some guys who don't know the answer, but we know to sit still and to do nothing is certainly not the answer. And I think that's what's implied in the title, is just going on. You know, we move forward through our lives. We don't even know how or why, but somehow we do.
We hold our breath till the morning comes, and at last the sun shines through. But the night's so hard that it seems impossible. But what else can we do? Going on. Listen, you'll hear it. We're getting near it. It's coming, I can feel it, 'cause I know you're gone away. Listen. We're getting near it. We tell ourselves that it's all just normal, till the worst of it is gone. And then you give up, and you give out, and you just can't take it. How do we keep going on? Going on. Going on. Listen.
With the Flaming Lips on the World Cafe. I asked leader Wayne Coyne about the title of the new album, At War with the Mystics, and what the Mystics meant to him.
Well, you know, when I came up with this title, I think it's going on a couple of years ago now, someone was asking me if I had a title for our new record. And we, you know, we work on these records sometimes forever, it seems like. And so people are always curious. And I came up with this title, At War with the Mystics, which I really think was just a song I was working on at the time. But I read later, when I'd seen it written up in a newspaper or something, that I thought this was a great, meaningful title, you know, meaningful, thinking that this was great resonance to our times or whatever. And I thought, well, that sounds good. I'll sort of go with that. It wasn't really by accident. I just didn't really felt as though it had too much meaning to it. I thought it just sounded cool, and so I went with it. But I think we found as we were recording that having this title to sort of work under really came as a great help, because we would, once we knew what the record was, the theme of the record kind of was, I think we started to write songs that sort of worked into that theme. And a lot of times, especially with rock and roll records, you know, you just do a bunch of songs and at the end of it hope that you end up with a cool title. And this almost worked the other way, kind of like making a movie or something where you kind of know what the movie's going to be about and you fill it all in, you know. And I didn't give it a lot of thought as to what the Mystics are. But since I've been talking about it now for about 3 or 4 months, I've really come to grips with what the mystics are now that we've talked about it for a long time. It's funny how that's the way it really works. People think you have it all worked out in your head, but really you don't. And as I talk to people about it, they've given me some great answers.
Would you rather that people didn't have to explain all these things? I mean, would you rather that we all keep them in our own heads?
No, no. I mean, I think that's really one of the hallmarks of art, is that it reaches people who are curious about its meaning. And I think it makes it a lot better. I think instead of me sitting here saying, oh, it just means one specific thing and everybody else is wrong, I really like this idea that it can all be sort of subjective, that I can suggest something and your own creativity can make it, you know, sort of fill in the gaps wherever you want it. And I think that's great. And so as I talk to people and they tell me their version of it, I sometimes think, well, that's much better than my version. You know, that's a lot more interesting. And so I sort of incorporate all these different suggestions of meaning into it. And so I think when I talked initially about being at war with the Mystics, even the sense I couldn't tell if I was at war against mysticism or mystics, or if I was on the side of the mystics. That's why I kind of liked it. Like, it left me some room to, you know, still pick, and, you know, which side I wanted to be on. And I think now, even that the record's out, I don't think it clearly says. And so my stance is this: I don't like mysticism and mysteries and magic that sort of clouds the truth. And at the moment, you can see I'm wearing this this George Bush pin with a X going through his head. I think when I talk about mysticism in the sense of what's happening right now, I use George Bush as an example of a person who hides the truth behind this wall of mysticism. And I say that by he would wake up and say, well, you know, God told me to go to war in Iraq. So, David, I would be against that sort of mysticism. I'd be at war against that. But the sort of mysticism that I'm in favor of and hope that I'm really absorbed into and part of is mysticism and magic that lies behind the truth. And the way that I would explain that is like, say, me and you want to believe in UFOs.
Yes.
I know you do, David.
Yes.
And but we would have to say, well, what's the truth behind UFOs? You know, are these little fuzzy things that we see on videotapes and photographs, are those real? We would have to say, well, probably not. Those just seem, you know, we can't believe that all this, these stupid stories of people being abducted, those obviously aren't the truth. But we know that we could look out into the universe in its vastness, in its endlessness, and think, you know, there probably is potential for other life out there, that possibly other life somewhere that someday we'll find out about. So that's what I mean. Like, so we know what the truth is. And that these things that we see, you know, these little blips on videotape, that's not real. But behind that is great, wonderful, magical mysteries that are real. And so, you know, I don't want to go through life and just destroy every mystery that comes along. Otherwise, you know, life as you go is just going to end up being no fun, you know. So that's what I think somewhere in there is we're fighting to keep one mystery and yet dissolve another one.
As much fun as this is, I bet you people want to hear some music. So let's play some more. You have a really different version of the AAA song.
Right. I mean, when we write these songs, you don't really know which way they're going to go. And sometimes the sentiment within the song can be taken almost to be absurd and funny and ridiculous. But with a slight change to the song can really be something that's really sad and kind of mournful and almost serious. And really it almost being the exact same song with slightly different chord structure. And again, I think that that points out sort of the endless skill that Stephen has over the mastery of these different styles of music. And the Yeah song on the record is this kind of T-Rex meets like sort of Gwen Stefani rave up. That's really, I think, kind of if nothing, absurd and happy. And this version that we'll do here today is actually very, very sobering and somber. And some of the lyrical content really trades its place from being something where we're kind of making fun of power to really almost being in awe of it and kind of sad about it the same way. So see if it hits you that way.
If you could blow up the world with a flick of a switch, would you do it? If you could make everybody poor just so you could be rich, would you do it? If you could watch everybody work while you just lay on your back, would you do it? With all
If you could make your own money and then give it to everybody, would you do it? And if you knew all the answers and you could give it to the masses, would you do it?
There you go, a very different version of the Yeah, Yeah, Yeah song from Flaming Lips playing live today. And we're getting a chance to talk to Wayne, who is in Oklahoma City today at home. And what is the band's profile in OK City? Are you revered? Has it changed? Are there statues? Are there Flaming Lips days?
Oh, I like that. Well, I don't think we've considered statues yet, but I would definitely I'd go for a statue. I say it's always better to not have a statue and deserve one, right, yeah, than to have one and not deserve it.
Well, then they can't tear it down, yeah.
Well, they can always complain about the guy who is there. No, I think we're as loved as you could possibly be. I mean, everywhere I go, especially amongst the musicians and artists, I think they look to the Flaming Lips as a shining example of an artist who persevered or, you know, just through sheer will, you know, was able to be original despite, you know, their circumstances. But I try to remind people, really, I'm just doing what I like, and I love living here, so I wouldn't think of moving as a career, you know, something that would be better for my career. And, you know, yeah, it just has worked out really to that Oklahoma City and Oklahoma in general has really become part of our identity. I mean, everywhere we go, we're the Flaming Lips from Oklahoma, and it's kind of like being from outer space or something. It really is something that we had no control over. That ended up being a marvelous little piece of our identity.
Now we have time for one more.
All right.
What shall it be?
This is one of the more somber cosmic sort of songs on the record. It's called Vein of Stars. And I believe when I first stumbled upon this song, I think I was trying to sing about the absence of there being anything out there in the universe that cared about us. And I was being very stern and existential, David. You know, I was trying to be, you know, I was trying to suck it up and be real and romantic at the same time. But I think you'll see as the song goes on, it starts out being very proclaiming this thing. But by the end of it, I think I've caved in. And even despite my own intellect, I want to believe that there's some magical thing out there within the realm of the stars and space that cares about us. Something happens in music that makes it better.
Keeping the mystery. This is Vein of Stars. Wayne, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having us. It's been fun.
Wayne Coyne from Flaming Lips, and we'll finish up with this performance from At War with the Mystics of Vein of Stars.
Who knows? Maybe there isn't a vein of stars calling out my name. No glow from above our heads. Nothing that could see you down your knees.
Vein of Stars, finishing up our set with Flaming Lips. Thanks again to Wayne Coyne and the Flaming Lips. That new album, At War with the Mystics, is available at our World Cafe CD store, which is, along with everything else, at our website at worldcafe.npr.org.